This is an interview with Mrs. Leslie Hindley, and her daughter is here too, that's Susan Pitt. And Mrs. Hindley will be speaking with me, Barry York, for the Oral History Program of the Museum of Australian Democracy at Old Parliament House. And I do want to thank you for agreeing to be part of this, Leslie. Thank you so much. Do you understand that the Commonwealth will have copyright in the interview material, but when you complete the rights agreement, we will abide by, you know, any restrictions?
Yes, I understand that, Barry.
Thank you. And can we make a transcript or a summary of the recording if we have the
Certainly.
Resources? Thank you. The interview is taking place today, 7th of November 2013, at the museum. Let's begin at the beginning. Can you tell me a bit about your background? Let's start with when and where you were born and how you ended up in Canberra.
Oh, right, Barry. Well, I was a very small premature baby, 2 pounds, 2 ounces, born in New Zealand and survived. The youngest of 9 children. My father was a mining engineer and came to Mount Isa in 1935. I was born in 1931 and I came to Mount Isa, and we stayed there until the evacuation virtually of the of Queensland, when they were going to have the Brisbane line, which was when the Japanese were coming down from New Guinea, and we all wanted to get away. So we came to Sydney. My parents then had guest houses in Sydney. I then did a hairdressing and beautician course for 2 years at a college. Then I went to Tasmania, worked in a mental home for 2 years. Came back to Sydney, worked in the hairdressing again. Then I met my husband, Rob Chalmers, and in dancing classes, actually. And after about 18 months, we decided to get married. Rob was then a junior reporter for the Daily Mirror in Canberra. Came to Canberra a couple of times for a journalist's ball, and then we decided when we'd get married that we'd come to Canberra to live if he could get permanent work. In those days, the newspapers and government wanted people to come to Canberra, and they supplied accommodation. He was living at the Hotel Civic at that period with a lot of other journalists. And when I came down, when we first married, we stayed there for a couple of weeks. Then we moved to Havelock House, which was then a hostel for government people. And then finally we moved to Lawley House, which was close to Parliament House, and we could ride our bikes up here then without having to get public transport.
Thank you for that. I'll go back slightly and ask a couple of questions. Now, did you come from a large family originally?
Yes, I did, Barry. I was the youngest of 9 children. I had 5 sisters and 3 brothers. My mother was a school teacher, and my father was a very good footballer, and he represented the North Island in rugby union. Anything we ever did that was good towards sport, my mother always said, "Congratulate your father on that, because he was a wonderful sport." Mm-hmm. Mother was very industrious and bossy, and it's gone right through the whole family. I'm bossy, my daughter's bossy, and the grandchildren are also bossy.
Tell Barry about your sisters and who stayed in New Zealand and who came to Australia, and a bit about Mount Isa.
We had when the war came to the Second World War, my sisters' husbands joined up from New Zealand, and that's one of the reasons why we had big boarding houses in Sydney, because they brought their whole family across and rented their houses in New Guinea, in New Zealand, and then came back to Sydney My elder sister Gladys had three children, and Gwen, my other sister, had one. But Gwen came to Mount Isa, and her husband was in Crete. He was a tank driver. He was blown up, actually, and had 14 in a tank. He had 14 bullets down the side, and he came back a very sick person. But they stayed together over the years. But he was always quite an invalid. My elder sister Gladys's husband had gone to the war too. My other two sisters' husbands were in New Guinea, so all the men seemed to be at the war in those days. I was always frightening the kids at school by telling them, because we had a radio and not many people had one then, and I'd hear about the war and I'd tell them it was all coming tomorrow to Mount Isa, and everyone was digging air raid shelters, and I was always frightening people because I was always had a good imagination.
Now, let's tell Barry about the boarding house in Mount Isa. How many there were.
My father was a mining engineer, but what happens in those days, the basic wage was about £3 in 1935 a week, but you had a large mining lead bonus. It was £12 a week, which was a fortune. That's why most people came from New Zealand and all over Australia to try and work there in the mines. But what happened, that was your compensation. If you got leaded, that meant that the lead had gone into the bloodstream. They tested you regularly. Then you were just dismissed, because that was it. So after 2 years, my father was dismissed, and having the last four children in Mount Isa, my mother, who was the industrious one, started off with a small boarding house, and mum and dad both cooked. So I virtually grew up with, in the end, 140 men. And that's how many boarders we had, lots of people. My school teachers were even boarded with us, everyone boarded with us.
And they were doing three shifts a day, weren't they?
Three shifts a day, yeah, three shifts a day, mining shifts. And in those days, we lived two doors from a hotel, and I think the next door was a brothel, but I didn't know about it then. There were a lot of men around, but lots of fights and things like that. Very different town, very different, it was a wild town. I went to school with Aboriginal children. I used to start off in the daytime with my shoes and socks on, coming from New Zealand, and a big hat that my mother had me in, and then by the time I got to school I'd take them off, because all the Aboriginal children, the others, didn't have any shoes, and I used to look too posh. So then after about 18 months my mother moved me to the mine school, which was a normal school. But I still remained friendly with lots of the Aboriginal children that were there. But they lived in a very, very nasty, on the river bank, an enclosure, which was very nasty, and with a lot of wire around them. That's one of the memories. And another memory I have of Aboriginals were climbing up a hill and looking over and seeing them all sitting camped at night, long white beards, and very, very sort of handsome people sitting there with their fires and very quiet. Mm. Now, no fights or anything with the Aboriginal people. They stayed right out of town. It wasn't a big population. Mining people, well, men were all drinking at the bars always. I learnt very early to sell the beer bottles with my brothers, and get them, and Dad made me a little billy cart, a little small one when I was about 8, and I was to collect the beer bottles. But I learnt that I had to ask the men to keep them for me, so I learnt to deal with men very early in life.
But when you were at school, did you want to be something particular when you grew up? Like, you know how often children want to be.
Well, because I grew up in a big boarding house with lots of men, lots of people, and I was and lots of waitresses and workers and cooks and things, I always felt special. I always felt special. I was the, sort of the daughter, you know, one of the daughters, and also being the baby daughter. The baby daughter, I always felt fairly special. The boys weren't allowed to hit me. The brothers weren't allowed to hit me, but if they did, I'd go and, you know, tell them straight away, tell on them, so they didn't. But I was sort of more or less protected, because my mother was 40 when she had me, and my father was 50.
Mm.
And so they were old parents, but I had a very happy life, very happy family.
And so, Mez, talking about your schooling, I know when you're in Sydney, you were offered a place.
Oh, yes.
At the...
Oh, yeah, when we came to Sydney to live...
How old were you when you moved to Sydney?
12. Okay. Oh, no, 11, actually, okay. 11.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went to Sydney, we moved to... when we first came, we arrived in Sydney on the day that the Japanese shelled the harbour. And we had a taxi. We had an aunt living in Sydney, and her son was a famous cricketer, Ray Lindwall, and we stayed with Auntie Queenie at Rose Bay. She had a nice big house there, then for overnight, and then we had to find accommodation. So because she lived at Rose Bay, we started around the Bondi area, and we were driving around. We went into Lamrock Avenue and got a unit and a flat there, and that's the night that they shelled it, and the shell went shooting over us. And Mum and Dad both smoked in private. They didn't smoke walking around. They smoked cigarettes, but only when they sat together. And Dad said in the air raid shelter, Mum said, "Did you bring the tobacco?" Well, I called it Toby. "Did you bring Toby?" And I said, "I'll go and get it." Mother said to me then, "You stay here, the Japs will get you straight away. You'll be the first with the Japs." So that kept me quiet.
What was the air raid shelter like?
Air raid shelter in the units. We had all, most people in Sydney had some sort of an air raid shelter. And you had them built, and all the parks had air raid shelters. You could go down into, run into a shelter in the park. There mightn't have been 50 of them, but all around they had air raid shelters.
And the one that you were in, was it?
In the units, were down underneath in the shelter.
So underneath.
It might have been in a big cellar, but everyone from these units were there. There were about 20 people.
Oh,
and there.
And was there an air raid warning?
Air raid warning, air raid sirens and that. Well, even when you're at school in Mount Isa, you had all these mock air raids. So that you'd all walk out and you'd know what to do. And that's why I was always alarming everyone, because I'd have the radio and I'd hear that who'd been bombed, and I was only about 8 then and 9, and I'd think, God, they'll be here soon. They were bombing last night and all the kids were screaming and around the place. And
now I'm trying to bring you back to when you were offered a place at the special school, the smart school.
Oh, yeah. When I came here, we went to Bondi. So I went to Bondi. Well, that's right. We went to Bondi. And my mum and dad bought a shop. That's what started it. Bought a shop, a mixed business at Dover Heights, Military Road, Dover Heights. So I went to Rose Bay Public School. And first of all, I went to... they bought a place, that's right, no, they bought a place at Centennial Park first, a small guest house, and I went to Kensington School for sixth class,
right.
And then we moved and bought the shop, then I went to Rose Bay. Now, I was always competitive and liked school, so I was always, the only person who could beat me at Rose Bay was one boy called Jimmy Larkin. And I could never beat him. I used to work really hard, but he always beat me. And I'd work again to beat him, because I used to have tests, and any test, I wanted to beat Jimmy. So it ended up that when I went the end of sixth class, I was chosen to go to Sydney High School, and was special school at that stage. And I came home, and my mother said, "Where was it?" And I said, "I don't know, it's right over." But she found out it was over by Darlinghurst. And the other school was down the road. And so she told me, "Don't go to that school." because you've got brown uniforms and it doesn't suit you brown. The blue uniform suits you and you look lovely in blue. So that's why I went to the domestic science then at Dover Heights. And I was the first girl in Dover Heights to use the toilet, so I ran, beat everybody. And we wore blue uniforms, and I was always in an A grade in Dover Heights. So.
Did you have a favourite subject?
Yes, I love physiology and architecture. Mm. And Doric columns and all that, and Ionic columns and things. I was really interested in that.
How did you see your future at that point?
I didn't see anything much future except, say, leaving school, getting my intermediate and leaving school and just, as my mother said, you've got to go to a college of some sort.
Okay.
Doesn't matter what it is. So I got my intermediate when I was 14, but I couldn't leave school till I was 15. And she said, well, you're not going to be a doctor and you can't be a nurse because you can't stand blood and you wouldn't be a doctor, you wouldn't be anything. So you better just go to college and learn shorthand and typing. And I didn't like the thought of that much. So I looked up the telephone book and found hairdressing college. And she said to me, you win. So that's where I went. At the age of 15, I left school in May. I was born in May and I started in May, in June, at 15, with my intermediate, but halfway through fourth year, because you went fourth year and fifth year. And I went straight to the Rondoli Hairdressing College in Sydney, which was in Gowing's Buildings in George Street. And loved it. And used to have raisin toast with girls and a cup of coffee and milkshakes and things. And so I completed that. I did 2 years there. You did beauty culture, hairdressing, beauty culture and massage and everything, but I had a happy time.
So you had the end of the war too, didn't you, around that time or not?
The war ended when I was at school. There's a story about me losing, and I did it again 50 years later. I lost a wedgie. Now, a wedgie's a shoe. That's a bit like now with a platform. And I went into town, came home, we all got half a day off because the school war was over. And I went into town with a cousin by tram and got caught up with the crowd and someone stood on my foot and I lost my shoe. And I lost my cousin, I lost everybody. So I limped home with one shoe on and one shoe off and then finally took it off and came back. And Mum said to me, you know, you're a brute of a girl, losing your shoe, you've lost, always doing something like that. So 50 years later, the big celebrations that they had, she'd always told me, if you lose anything, you go to a policeman. So I went to a policeman, put my name down. My name was Leslie Hyde. And I said to him that I've lost a wedgie, and he wrote it down. So 50 years later, I was with a group of women in Sydney, and they were Air Force women, and that I wasn't in the forces. And we're having a big celebration, and I said to them, I've got to go and ask this policeman, I lost a shoe here. So I said to him, excuse me, I don't know whether you've ever found the shoe or not. I said, it's a bit, and then his woman was that. I said, I reported it 50 years ago on this day. So I got a laugh out of him.
Yeah, you said that you were given the half day off school.
Yes.
Now, was the news broken to you at school?
Yes, the news was, because we went to, or maybe we'd gone to school and then they said, you can all go home. I'm just not sure about that, whether it was broken at school. But I remember the victory in Japan, then the victory in Europe. But both of those everyone went into town. But no, he couldn't get in. All the trams, the railings on the trams were taken off and nothing worked. No buses went, anything, all blocked. And you just had to walk home from right to Bondi. And I walked, and I didn't know how to get there, so I walked on the tram line. looking at behind me to see if a tram was coming, and I thought that'd be cunning. Mm-hmm. If a tram comes, I'll get it. But I followed the tram line all the way.
Mm-hmm. And you were only 15.
I was 14 then. Yes.
Yeah. Tell Mary what you said to your sister, or said the Americans, your sister June, when the Americans would make part of
that. Oh, yes. Well, I had very attractive sisters, you know, quite beautiful sisters. And I'm walking along, I was about 13, with the straight hair and the fringe and that, walking along, and my sister June, who was 7 years older than me, in those days, people would pick you up. They were just a matter of, you know, two sailors walking along and two girls, and they'd just give each other a whistle or a talk or just talk. That's how they met. And I'm scratching along there, and so Mum always said, look after your sister, to me. And I was a cheeky one, and she was a shy one, and when we were walking along, she gave me a nudge. These two blokes were looking at her. And as they came by, they said, hello, hello, heartache. I said, goodbye, headache. And June laughed, and they laughed too. When we got home, Mum, she said, oh, Leslie's funny, and she told Mum and Dad. And Dad said, you're a very good girl looking after your sister. Keep looking after her.
Did your parents have any particular political or religious
very attitudes? No religious views at all. None of the family were christened. I was asked my mother once why I wasn't christened, and she said, we were waiting for another child and you'd all be done together, the whole lot of you. And that was her story, and I believed that for a long time. And then one day she said to me, and I said once again, because I went to all the church, I went to Sunday school, you know, Methodist and Presbyterian, and mother was Presbyterian and father was Methodist, but they were sort of a bit with a no alcohol bit. You know, any alcohol came into the son-in-law's stomachs in our place. Didn't have wine or drink. I never saw much alcohol. Men drank round the pub and all around, and my mother used to say to me, isn't it disgusting, absolutely disgusting, the people drinking. And when she employed girls, she'd make sure that the girls weren't drinkers. Mm. Otherwise, they'd be sacked after a while. Yeah. If they were drinkers, you won't last in this town. What was the other thing?
The politics, were they?
Politics, very, very much Labor people. Very much, very, very Labor. It was a time that, in those days, my parents didn't come into the communist feelings, but most people then were coming after the war, wanting to get further into the social system and wanting to be. Lots of brother-in-laws joined the Communist Party and sold the Tribune. And then it all flitted away, you know, that way. But just after the war, they were very strong. And people even had me. Well, my brother-in-law used to talk to me all the time when I was 15 about socialism and what was happening in Russia. But then again, we went to school and we were friendly with Russia at that stage. It wasn't a Cold War. Mm. Very friendly with Russia. And one of the main subjects was the collective farming and at school, and how great they were and what was happening to the people. And we were great friends with Russia. And it was a very big disillusionment to me after the war when they started with the Cold War against Russia. I didn't understand all the politics. I didn't understand what was happening beforehand, you know, with the big powers. But later I learned. But then I was rather disillusioned when I was about 16 and 17 with that happening.
Do you remember the campaign for the sheep skins to Russia?
Yes, I can remember that. Just vaguely. I don't know a lot about it, but I do remember that. The thing is with my mother.
You had Auntie Rosa, didn't you, the Russian?
Oh, I had a Russian aunt. I had a Russian aunt. She came to.
Now, what side was she?
She married my father's brother. Okay. My father's brother. She was an auntie.
Right.
Yeah. And she came to the Russian ballet, the Russian.
Bolshoi.
Rouge or something.
Ballet Russe.
Ballet Russe or something. Okay. And she was always kicking her legs up and doing it. She went to New Zealand and met my uncle, and she had a six-year-old, five-year-old son, Victor. So he married her, and Victor became my... Well, I was only a little kid. Victor's gone now. And Victor... And then Milton and Glory were born, G-L-O-R-Y, then, because that's what she wanted, the name of Glory. Mm-hmm. And but Auntie Rosa, my uncle lived in New Guinea. He was looking for gold there and well. And when he died, he died from septicemia with a tree falling on his leg. But when Auntie came back, she bought a farm
in Sydney.
Yeah. Anyway, it just, which is now, it doesn't really matter. It was about 20 miles out of Sydney. Can't quite think of the name of it. Round Parramatta, Windsor Way, that way.
Right, yep.
And I used to go and stay with her on the holidays. Mm-hmm. And stay with her and frighten her, tell her stories about Russian women who had a, you know, she used to love my stories. And she used to tell me another story. And she used to say, "Mein Gott, Leslie, you make me laugh."
What was her name?
Rosa. Well, I don't know, Rosa. Okay. Rosa, that's all I knew.
It was Hyde at the end.
And Hyde, H-Y-D-E. Okay,
right.
She has a famous grandson now called Greg Hyde, who's an artist, a well-known artist. Mm-hmm. And that must have come from that Russian side with the art, because our side wasn't that very arty at all.
Right.
And Les, how did you get down to New Norfolk?
Oh, well, I went to New Norfolk. I was always yearning to go back to Mount Isa, because I liked Mount Isa, and I had little dreams of going back to Mount Isa and working my way up there after I got my diploma. And my mother said to me, and I said, "Could I go?" And she said to me, "You can go anywhere you like. The world's your oyster. Go anywhere you like. You hold a bird tight in the hand, it struggles to get away. Let it sit there, fly away, and it'll come back. So if you want to go, you can go." So I was 17, and I took off on my own with a suitcase and my bicycle and went to Brisbane. Lost my bag in the taxi and had no money. Ended up then going to the hotel, the Lennon's, and asking for a waitress job or a housemaid job, because then you could get a job and live in at the same time. So that's what I did, all in that one day. And then when I was there, I met this girl from Tasmania. Very nice to me. Woman she was then, with 22.
Please, sir.
She had about 24 years of age. And she had two children and a mother in Melbourne, and she wanted to go to Tasmania. Her husband had been killed in the war in New Guinea, and she wanted to go down there, so she talked me into going there. And I didn't mind. I thought, I'll go to Mount Isa another time. So I just flitted off back down to Sydney. And
how did you get there, Les? Did you catch a plane?
No, I caught a plane to Sydney, and I worked in the Arnott's Biscuit Factory for 6 weeks to get my fare to get to there, because you didn't have much money, or any money. And I got my fare and saw my family and went to Melbourne, and then I went to New Norfolk. Now, she told me that we were going to work in a nut factory. And I thought, and she was kidding me, because I thought it was Cadbury's Dairy Milk Nut Factory, and it was a mental home.
Oh.
And that's what we did, but she didn't mind. When I got there...
Just out of Hobart,
New Norfolk. So when I got there, and the chaps were on the gate, and she'd evidently told them, you know, and here I was.
Are you 16, 17?
I was 17. But she said, "You'll get the chocolate later." She told them, you see. And I said, "Where do they make the chocolate?" And he said, "Oh, down that big room down there." It was next day when I got the nurse's uniform, I woke up to it. So I stayed there for 18 months. And worked, and then the matron saw that I did their hair nicely, and so she put me in charge of the arts and crafts section with all the hair, so I was doing hair. Then I came back to...
Sorry, Les, while you were there, there were a lot of people that were, these days would be out in their community, so Down syndrome people.
Oh, yes. Oh, well, I worked on the D ward with Down syndrome people, and, you know, they used to watch me play tennis, and I used to get buy little tennis rackets for them, or give them my old tennis racket and sand shoes and... things, and Dorothy Hood was my favourite one that I told you about. When I was playing tennis, she used to stand at the tennis thing singing, "Good shot, nurse, good shot," even if I missed it. So she was great. Then I came back to Sydney, and then I went back to hairdressing college for a refresher.
Okay.
And that was Madame Gossamer. This is another place then, a different place, but called Madame Gossamer.
Where was that
at
one?
College as well in Sydney. Mm-hmm. And you paid about 3 guineas a month to go there, mm-hmm. which was quite a bit of money then in those mm-hmm. days.
Yes.
That was a basic wage, was free about £3 or £4, so it was quite expensive to go there. So anyway, I had the money and I went back, and she immediately put me in a hairdressing salon, which I managed then. Mm-hmm. And that's when I decided, I was getting a bit sick of just the hairdressing, but I was like that. But I felt, you know, that I'd done that.
Salon was it?
A salon, yes, with another couple of girls.
Where was it?
It was down near the railway, but up further, I've forgotten the street.
In the city, though?
In the city, yeah. Mm. But not towards King's Cross, the other side of Darlinghurst.
Okay, yep.
And then I got a little unit with a girl from school that I knew, and we shared a unit. Her father owned it in King's Cross. So I'd walk from King's Cross right across down into the hairdressing salon, and then my sister-in-law said to me, "Well, would you like to come to Lascot School of Ballroom Dancing?" So off I went, and men came along on the line and picked you up. And then that's where I got picked up by Rob Chalmers.
Okay.
And he said to me, "You're not a bad dancer for a short girl." And I said, "You're not so good for a tall boy."
Gee,
and he looked at me and thought, "She's a bit cheeky, you know," because he was a professional.
He was paid, wasn't he?
He was paid. He was paid to teach, and we were the beginners. But I really did enjoy dancing, and I didn't think I was a beginner. But he said, "You're not bad for a short... You're doing it quite well for a short person." And I said, "Well, you're not going so well."
So he worked there?
He worked in the Daily Mirror.
Ah, okay.
And as a D-grade cadet. And
they were paid at night to dance with them.
Paid at night. And then when I realised you got paid for going along there, I thought to myself, "Well, I better have a few dancing lessons." Not because of him. I didn't see him again for 6 months. But I then went mad on the dancing. And which I do, I sort of take up something with enthusiasm and want to do it well. And so I was having private lessons from Bill Lascott, who was the owner of the whole place, and learning. And I got my first medal, which was a bronze medal. Rob Chalmers had a gold medal, gold star, you see. But I didn't worry too much about him. And then they had the Sunday night where all the teachers got together. So that's when I went along there with another... I didn't know anyone, but I just met them there. Went along there and we danced like mad. And that's when he then said to me, "You've certainly improved." And I said, "Well, you're getting a bit better too." So then time went on and...
He'd been with Gloria and then they separated.
Well, he was going with Gloria then, but that's right, I was engaged to Peter Whitney. This chap that I'd known before I went to Tasmania,
mm-hmm.
and Peter was a very nice looking person, and nice family and all the rest of it. But he was 6 years older than I was, and he wanted to get married, and when I was about 17, and that's one of the reasons I sort of took off.
And tell the truth, what was the other reason?
What?
his red hair.
No, his mother had red hair.
You didn't want to have red-headed children.
Peter had very, very dark eyes and very dark hair. But, no, they were just a family, and I was right not to marry them. They were all... I was never very good at sewing and arty work and that, and they'd all sit around together, and they'd be, the girls would be sewing and the boys would be making things, and I think, God, I'm not too good at this. I could hardly tie a ribbon. Mm-hmm. And they were a lovely family, but I didn't... And they were so nice to me, but I just felt I didn't fit in.
Mm.
So when I met Rob Chalmers, whose mother was a hypochondriac, and went and stayed in bed the whole time.
My father was the only child.
He was an only child. So when I met them, and she just thought I was great, because then I did everything. Then I'd do the cleaning and I'd get everything done because I was a busy person. With the other people, I sat there not feeling very confident. So anyway, Rob and I married, came to Canberra, lived here.
Can I just ask, sorry to interrupt again, but are you married in Sydney?
Married in Sydney.
And
yes, and what happened, it's when Ben Chifley died, that their wedding was postponed for a week. Rob was a very strong political person, which he stayed in politics for over 60 years, but Ben Chifley was his great admirer. He admired Ben Chifley tremendously for how he'd come from lower from humble beginnings, and how it rose up, and still was a very humble man.
Mm-hmm.
And he admired him. Anyway, when we were booked to be married in the 1st of November, I think it was, and we got married on the 7th of November, so... I think the House got up, Parliament here got up, and Rob then had to come back. Didn't had to.